you do a great job in talking about what an MLM is and debunking the actual untruths. And you actually spin it on its head to say, you know, people say that the MLM is this, this, and this. Well, actually, that's the perfect definition of what a pyramid is.
That's exactly right.
Right? Just go ahead and hit that. Go into that.
Yeah. So people say, oh, well, the MLM, you know, you get in early and then you get all these, you recruit all these people underneath you and they recruit people underneath them. And then, you know, the bigger you can build your pyramid, you're sitting up at the top making all this cash and everybody else is doing all your volume and you know, working, doing all the work, and you sit up there, you know, going on cruises. Well, that's a pyramid. Well, no. To me, that's called hard work in capitalism. A pyramid is when you are sitting at the bottom with no authority or control over your ability to move up, and you're competing against the people next to you, and you're competing against the people around you, and there are fewer slots above you than there are people who want those slots. That's a pyramid, and that is called corporate America. And MLM's not that way. If you really wanted to examine the structure, an MLM is more like an upside-down pyramid, where you are the point at the bottom, and the only place to go is up, because you can't go laterally. Literally, there is no structure for you to go laterally in an MLM. You either go up or you quit. It's the only two options. And the greatest part about it, and what I have come to understand, which took me 13 years to realize, and having been pitched the MLM model many, many times before I actually was humble enough to read what it was instead of just assuming my preconceived notions were correct, is that where else can you find a business where someone's success is fully dependent on how successful they can make you? Because I look at the person who sponsored me, and he has called me, texted me, worked with me, given up his own precious time to come study with me, sent me audio files, given me books, invited me to trainings, given me trainings. I mean, literally, this man has invested more time in the success of my life than any other boss I've ever had in my life. And you ask yourself, why? Why would he spend this much time and effort investing his own resources into me and my business? Well, the answer is simple. Because to the extent that he can help me succeed in the way that he has succeeded, he succeeds more. And literally, by him trying to make me the absolute best person and businessman that I can be, we elevate each other. And when I see that, it inspires me and makes me want to do the same for somebody else. Where else in business can you find a group of people who are maniacally trying to get other people to succeed? The more success that an individual has, the more success there is to go around. Tell me in corporate America where you have a boss who is dedicating his spare time outside of his normal 60 hours a week to come mentor you because he is dying to have you become successful like him. No. Bosses are scared of you because if they make you too successful, guess what's going to happen? You will become them and they're going to be gone. There's no duplication in the corporate pyramid, but the MLM structure, because it's an upside down pyramid, it thrives on duplication.
Yeah, right on, man. What you just described perfectly in an MLM structure, if we want to call it that, that upside down pyramid, is actually what makes a family successful, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Empowerment.
Right.
While I was on vacation last week in Destin, I don't think it's in this notebook, it's a different one, I was working on two different ideas, and I was having a hard time. One of them was entitlement, and I was doing this word cluster around the word entitlement. People feel that they are entitled to certain rights and privileges, that they deserve them just by simply existing. That's something you mentioned there, just, you know, get a paycheck just because you exist, right?
Right.
And I was having a hard time. I even went on a thesaurus online, and I couldn't find the exact antonym or the opposing word that would sum up the opposite of entitlement.
I would interject here and say, while it may not be a direct antonym in terms of concept, I would say the exact opposite of entitlement is responsibility.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people think, oh, responsibility, it means like, you know, taking responsibility for something or admitting when you're wrong or something like that. But no, when you really understand the breadth of the word responsibility, it is entitlement and responsibility can't exist in the same space.
I love it. The word, and so responsibility is on there. Accountability is another one. The word that actually came up when I was like, wait a second, empowerment, mm-hmm. right? And so entitlement versus empowerment. So when you're empowering somebody, and here's a funny story. My phone, this phone right here, well, not this phone. This is a LifeProof case. Great product. I use it, shockproof, waterproof. And then I also have a pouch that I carry our devices in so we can go underwater, like when we go to water parks and stuff. Short story is, my phone that I ended up taking out of the case. I took it out of that bag. I got water in it unknowingly last week in Destin. T-Mobile said, yeah, you have insurance. Oh, by the way, you have to use Apple Care. We can't do anything. So you'll have to get it fixed when you get back to Houston. So I went the whole week without my phone. I get here to Houston on Sunday. I go on Apple's website, get an appointment with a genius for Tuesday that said, that's not going to work. I need my phone for work. So I accept that appointment. Nothing else is available nearby. Monday morning at 7 o'clock, I go online. I see that I can go to Memorial City. I have an appointment there at 12:20, go down there. I check in 40 minutes later. They don't call me. I'm like feeling something's off. So I go up to the guy I checked in with. I said, hey, just want to check. And he goes, his name's Eric, by the way. And he says, somehow it got canceled. One of his coworkers oversaw what he was doing and she jumped in to try and help me out. And he goes, oh, somehow it got canceled. And so he walked away because he didn't want to get called out. I found out he's a new hire there. He goes to the big guy who's in charge there. And I can see there's some rambling going on. He comes back to me and says, well, you're on the list now to get seen. I'm like, okay, well, I've been here for 40 minutes. You know, do you have an idea? I can see you guys are busy. Do you have an idea? Because I sort of need my appointment. He goes, oh, I don't, but you'll be seen. Don't worry about it. So I ask him this. And I said, did you accidentally cancel my appointment? He goes, oh, and he just points to the device. He didn't want to take any accountability or remotely accept any kind of... A lady named Sandra, who I met a second later, saw that. He walks away. She saw I was unhappy. I wasn't rude. Like some of the people that go in there are entitled. Apple, just the mentality of some of these folks, are like Amazon customers sometimes. She looks at him. She looks at me. She's probably about 20 years my senior. And she goes, you know the problem with that boy? And I didn't say anything, okay? She goes, the problem with that boy is he was raised by a mom who never taught him to take responsibility. So you said that word. I'm like, I'm thinking about Eric over there. I ended up getting help by a guy named David who was fantastic there. Replaced my phone. No questions asked. But that really stuck with me because I was sort of in this moral dilemma where I wanted to go talk to the manager and say, listen, I just want to give you some feedback. I don't work in corporate America. I'm at the vulnerability of projects. You know, I have my own business, but I want to give you this feedback and I hope it'll do something. But I really didn't feel that my feedback would go anywhere with them. And so to avoid confrontation and potentially getting upset and making a scene, I just kept it to myself. But that's a perfect example of what you're talking about with responsibility, empowering people. So tell me about your upbringing and how that influenced this whole mindset of sticking things out, because you have a lot of stick-to-itness.
Okay, yeah. It was my mother's side that was Asian. She's Chinese, and my father's side is he grew up in New York, you know, your very typical mixture of white, Caucasian nationalities. But he grew up on a farm. And so I kind of got it from both sides. Because anyone who's ever worked on a farm knows that you can't be lazy on a farm. You can't. Because if you're lazy on a farm, guess what? Guess what? You don't have dinner. You don't have dinner. And then just in Asian culture in general, basically, the way they view life is that if you don't work hard and become successful in whatever arena it is that you choose to pursue, then that's like a black mark on your family. Yeah, that's a black mark on your family. That's a black mark on your parents, the elders who raised you. That's a black mark on you as a human being. It's like, you don't do that as an Asian. You just don't. So I kind of got it from both sides because on my white side, my dad was, he's one of those guys. And I believe that you can learn something from everybody. So my dad was the quintessential ExxonMobil manager. He took the corporate track. I mean, it was like his life is exactly the perfect American, you know, process. Grew up, got straight A's in high school, went to college, got straight A's, joined the ROTC, went served in the military. Very proud of his service. You know, proud of all. I just want to say thank you to all the military servicemen who, you know, for those of us civilians here, we can't even imagine what those guys have been through. But he gave military service, came back, went to grad school, got an MBA, all on scholarship because his grades were fantastic. Straight out of MBA program, got hired on as in human resources for ExxonMobil, worked there for the next 31 years, became a manager, was very, very diligent throughout his life in saving and not spending a dime outside of what he had to spend. And like I said, we grew up with hand-me-down clothes. Ended up retiring at 53.
Wow.
And lived a very, very comfortable retirement and is continuing to live a very comfortable retirement. Now, again, kind of that kind of goes against the grain of what my article is about because I don't want to be a part of corporate America. But for him and his goals and aspirations, that fit what he was looking for. And so that's why I say, if that's what you're looking for, you can be successful in that. If that's what you're looking for. And he did that, and now he's living a very, very, you know, a great lifestyle. He's got money in the bank. He doesn't have to worry about it. He's, you know, he retired at 53. And so from him, if I had to use one word to describe what I took away from my father, was persistence. Just an unreal amount of persistence. It was like you could tell this guy to sharpen 600,000 pencils and he could do it no problem. He'd just sit there sharpening pencils. I mean, he was persistent to the point that he could literally do anything, not because of raw talent, but because he simply would not stop until it was done. And that's what I picked up from my dad. And he was never the kind to get discouraged. I'm sure there was a point in his life where he experienced discouragement, but I never saw it. I always viewed him as like, you know, he'd go to work and he'd come home and I'd be like, man, this dude is going to work, sitting in traffic, and it doesn't even faze him. I mean, it phases me just thinking about it, but he was just the definition of persistence. And then there was my mom, and that's where I got my dreamer side. She was the dreamer. She grew up in Hong Kong, originally Taiwan, moved to Japan, and her family fell on hard times. They ended up moving to Hong Kong. They were wealthy in Japan, but there was some issues there, and they ended up in Hong Kong with very, very little money. Lived in a tiny, tiny little apartment. When she was a teenager, so she was like 13 at the time, she had full of personality, ended up getting a job as a radio show host in Hong Kong. So she did that and loved it. She loved the arts of any kind. She loved to dance. She loved to sing.
She was a creative.
She was a creative, an absolute 100% creative. Ended up deciding to go to come to America for college. She came to America. She joined the Young Ambassadors, ended up becoming a member of that performing group, toured the world. Doing song and dance performances. She also did a stint out at BYU Hawaii for a while, where she joined Showcase Hawaii, which was another performing group out there. So, I mean, she was a part of the first group that went on the USO tour to Russia. She went on the first tour to China when there had never been a religiously affiliated group in China before, as with them as a communist nation. BYU's Young Ambassadors were the first group first religiously affiliated group to enter China. She was a part of that group. Ended up getting married. She had a bachelor's degree, a master's degree. She went through the whole thing. She was one of the most talented people in the world in terms of just absolute brain power, but she loved the arts. She absolutely loved the arts. She was a creative. And got married, had kids, started a family, did the whole stay-at-home mom thing. Drove her crazy. So she ended up signing up with a modeling agency. Started modeling because she thought, well, I'm in Houston. There's not a whole lot of Asians here at the time, particularly in Kingwood. We were probably one of the only three Asian families.
Wow.
So I started modeling, became successful at that. Thought, well, shoot, if I can model, I can act. So she started acting. She ended up getting a role in RoboCop 2. I don't know if you've ever seen that movie. Which, by the way, when she got selected for the role after her audition, she told them, you know, I don't want to participate if it's going to be a rated R movie because I don't want to be a part of something that's extremely violent or explicit. And the director was like, oh, no, this is PG, definitely PG. We're not gonna have, you know, this is a movie that anyone can watch. And she said, okay, great. So she brought us, we get on set the first day they're shooting with her scene involved. We get there and I've never heard so many F words in my life. And she stomped right up to the producers and she said, they told me this wasn't gonna be, you know, R-rated. And this is definitely R-rated. People's, you know, they had the little brain matter packets that, you know, on people's heads that would explode when they got shot, and blood was flying everywhere. And I was super little, sitting there in my pajamas, my eyes as big as cue balls, just like, what is happening? And but anyways, because she had committed, she ended up finishing it. Did the scene. If you've seen RoboCop 2, it's the scene at the beginning where RoboCop, he does a drug bust on this drug factory, and it's run by a bunch of Chinese workers who are producing the drugs. And at one point, there's an Asian lady who has a baby, and the bad guy steals the baby from the Asian lady, and RoboCop has to confront the bad guy to get the baby back because the bad guy's holding the baby hostage. Well, that's my mom's baby in the movie. She's the woman who's crying next to the bad guy, hoping that RoboCop will save the baby, and her lines are all in Chinese because, you know, that was her role. But anyway, the point is that she had this passion for the arts. And so she ended up bringing my sister and I to modeling and acting, and we did commercials and we did, you know, modeling gigs here and there. I ended up getting a gig with Shell gasoline, where I was I did a dare to say no to drugs advertisement with a police officer, and they had my face was plastered all over the Shell gas stations above the pumps, which is funny because I now work for Shell. What I picked up from her was, if I could sum it all up into one phrase, and we've all heard this phrase, every child who grew up in the 80s and 90s has heard this phrase, but I don't believe that every child really believed it. What she would say is, you can become anything if you're willing to work hard for it. And that stuck with me. You can become anything. Like I said, we've all heard that. It's not a new phrase. She didn't make it up. The difference was I believed it. But somewhere along the line, because of the influence of traditional society, I never stopped believing it, but for a period of time, I forgot it. And I started telling myself that in order to be successful, I had to have a steady job, I had to have a good wage, I had to make a good hourly income so that I could buy a nice house, so that I could have a nice TV. And if I did that, then I would be able to label myself as successful. And I set aside the things that she had told me, that I could become anything if I was willing to work for it. And I'm not willing to set that aside any longer. And that's essentially why I wrote this article. And I'm not willing to watch other people set that aside any longer.